go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running, 11 minutes late, but we're off and running. And just checking real quick, all the third switches are thrown and the buttons are pushed and the things are clicked. And yes, this program is live. It's 10 minutes late, but it's live. And I can only tell you that for some reason or another, every now and then, it forgets or goes like deaf to the sound card or something, and then I have to perform strange rituals that are seldom seen outside Appalachia, and then it works again. Go figure. I got nothing. But we're here, and that's what matters. Because, after all, this is the fifth of 5 days of fundraising free radio on the horn. We met our fundraising goal for the month of March, and that meant that thanks to our subscribers, we were able to have 5 days of fundraising free radio. I had a note, by the way. I had a note from Terry up in Amherst, where only the H is silent, who said, wait a minute, I subscribed on the 29th, and it's that thing with the subscription things with PayPal. Your subscription came through on the 28th, because there's only 28 days in February. So after February, everybody who subscribed on the 29th, the 30th, or in some cases the 31st, if anybody did, it all got bumped back to the 28th. So, it's kind of fitting in a way, though, if you know what I mean. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Friday on the front porch. It's kind of fitting that in the final week of the broadcast month, the 29th and the 30th, and the 31st in this case, there aren't any subscribers. Why do I say fitting? Because we have the fundraising free radio because we've got enough subscribers to knock down about a week's worth of any given month's funding. That's how that works in the long run. And so there are no subscribers to thank this evening, except to thank, since this is the last broadcast of March, to thank all the subscribers over at Patreon and at PayPal. Thank you all for knocking down a quarter of the fundraising goal for any given month. And thank you so much to everybody who helped us reach the fundraising goal and, well, the fundraising necessity for the other 3 weeks. And the rest of the month, generally speaking. There's no program without you, period. And the fact of the matter is, this is not fundraising. This is just pointing out that if you would like to become a Patreon subscriber, well, those subscriptions all come out on the first of the month, not the 29th or the 28th or anything like that. If you'd like to become a Patreon subscriber, go on over to patreon.com/Bob Kincaid, and that way you can be part of helping to keep the program on the air, given the realities of our merry little band. If everybody contributed about 48 cents per program, less than 17, some maybe even less than 16 cents per hour, then we would never have to, I'd never have to say another word about fundraising. But it seems to be like it's very difficult to get a number of people to turn loose of that 48 cents. And thanks so very, very much to the ones who are willing to keep the program on the air. Thank you so very much indeed. If anything you want to do, like get in the chat room, chat room's up and running. And I would be forever grateful to Add-On, the folks over at Add-On Chat, if they would fix their... security certificate so that people will stop being terrified to go to the chat room because they haven't updated their security certificate. I mean, it ain't rocket science. The chat room is just fine, and folks are beginning to wander in this evening. If you would like to participate in the chat room, of course, pick yourself out a screen name and a password at headon.live, HEADON.LIVE. And jump right in, and you'll be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Silent R. Lamar and VT Vlom, all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a Spacing Guild master, has this afternoon in the far reaches of Northern California folded space to become Man Cave. Yes. So that's where that, you know, that and everybody will be tickled pink. Tickled pink to see you. Like I said, it's Friday on the front porch, and here in about, 42 minutes or so, we'll fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable and see what's on everybody's mind who wishes to participate. If you have participated in the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable in the past, then please consider yourself welcome to join in this evening. If you have never participated in the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable that is Friday on the front porch, then by all means, send a contact request on Skype, to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Sparky Dunk, and he will put out the breadcrumb trail for you and generally show you how to get into the room, and you'll be part of a rousing, rollicking, back-and-forth conversation that is unlike anything that happens anywhere else that I'm aware of. And which, in fact, we've been doing here for years and years and years. In fact, our first Fridays on the Front Porch went way back to when we had multiple telephone lines coming in here into a really expensive highfalutin telephone hybrid that the fine folks at Frontier Communications fried like an egg. And that was, and back then, people could just call in via the phone and participate in Friday on the Front Porch. That doesn't happen anymore because of the aforesaid fried like an egg, very expensive telephone hybrid contraption. It's all strictly via Skype. So if you want to participate in Friday on the Front Porch, well, you need to connect with Sparky, and we'll get the whole thing going, like I said, in about 40 minutes or so. Thank you very kindly, Marty, for reminding me. Happy Cesar Chavez Day from California. Happy day indeed. Yeah, I know. Xylan R. Lamar points out, oh, now, Bob, if Add-On did what they were supposed to do, that would be right. Really? Well, yeah, I know. That's the problem with all of this highfalutin technology stuff thingy. Mm-hmm. We're live and hot on both the headon.live stream and the whiterosesociety.org stream. That means we're live on TuneIn and Stitcher and Roku and FYI Nation and Golly Moses. We're easy to find. You just have to know we're here in order to participate in the conversation. And a reminder, based on... Based on the topic we touched on yesterday, a reminder, this is wingnut-free radio. This is right-wing-free radio. Not radio that's free to right-wingers. It's free to everybody who wants to participate. It's just that, well, right-wingers aren't allowed to participate. Wouldn't it be just beautiful if we let them? I mean, if we, here at the Horn, if we engaged in wingnut affirmative action welfare like the Atlantic did with Kevin Williamson, wouldn't that just be grand? There's still some head-scratching going on out there in the world of the media elites, as they are referred to. The latest coming from someone by the name of Michelle Goldberg over at the New York Times, who was just positively scratching her little noggin about the Atlantic hiring Kevin Williamson, all the time being absolutely clueless to the fact that Kevin Williamson was only able to carry his flaming cross through the door of the doorway of the Atlantic as a result of the opening that the New York Times gave to noted climate change denier and rape denier Bret Stephens on the op-ed pages of the New York Times itself. Mm-hmm. I know. Oh, by the way, if you're feeling a little bit peaked in these early days of spring, let me tell you a little something new from the fine folks, the hardworking periodontic peripatetic scientists over at Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter. That's right, friends, neighbors, countrymen. I'm talking about Blandilicus bloodroot is a proprietary formulation brought to you only by the peripatetic periodontic hardworking scientists at Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter. Yes, Blandilicus bloodroot will pick you up, pep you up, and make you feel better about yourself, because it is Blandilicus bloodroot in a freeze-dried, dehydrated, proprietary form packaged into capsules that now have a clean ergonomic grip. Every capsule comes with a clean ergonomic grip that you can use as you take a handful of the worthless little son of a guns. Mm-hmm. Blandilicus bloodroot can be yours in a 90-day supply for only $219.54, plus an exorbitant amount for shipping and handling, which we will calculate upon receiving your credit card number at Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter. Yes, yes, Blandilicus bloodroot is, of course, vegan, cage-free, free-range, cruelty-free, gluten-free, soy-free, and nutrition-free, because just like everything else that's hustled out there on Facebook and on the radio and so forth, it's a completely bullshit nutritional supplement that has no beneficial value whatsoever. None at all. Blandilicus bloodroot with the clean ergonomic grip only from Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter. You know, I've never cared much for bloodroot, but thanks to clean ergonomic-gripped Blandilicus bloodroot from Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter, I know I can get all the bloodroot that I could possibly want in any given day. And I don't. Call now. Operators aren't standing by. This is not a free call. Your mileage may vary. Blandilicus bloodroot. FOBCOD, PTA, CIA, MDMA, LSD, Blandilicus bloodroot, only from Horn Nutraceuticals, at Horn Labs on Twitter, now with the convenient, clean, ergonomic grip. So there we go. That's our nutritional supplement for the evening. But don't be surprised if I work in a mention every now and then throughout the program for, what? Say it with me, friends and neighbors, Blandiloquus Bloodroot, only from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. You'll be glad you didn't. Fascinated, well, and of course, an observation of the day. I'm really not good with religious holidays, I confess. I completely blew through yesterday without noting or realizing that it was Maudlin Thursday. No, really. And last week was Palm Oil Sunday. You know that maybe it's because I was raised in Christianity that I'm not worth a damn with mathematics. Because I could never figure it out. They got their Maudlin Thursday and their Good Friday, which is today. But if Jesus got up and went walkabout on Sunday, Easter Sunday, then if he was dead for 3 days, that'd mean Saturday, Friday, and Thursday. Right? Or else, and so it's kind of hard figuring out how it is that there's anything particularly good about Friday. You reckon the guy who was getting murdered by the Romans thought that this particular day was particularly good? It's a manifestation of the sort of gross death cult that Christianity became, that they would take the second day of the dude hanging on the cross getting, or maybe the day he got taken, who knows, who can make any sense out of it, and decide that that was a good Friday. Because I'm betting if you were to, you know, find old zombie Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi who wore a dress every day of his life, and say, hey, what'd you think of that day? My guess is the first words that would, the word that came out of his mouth to describe that particular Friday would not be good. Oh, well, wait a minute. Okay, I owe Silent R. Lamar cowbell for this. Silent R. Lamar just made it all make sense. International Dateline, Bob, he got a day back. And probably daylight savings time, too. Yeah. And of course, I was watching, I'm a big Mary Beard fan over at the BBC, and I was watching her Ultimate Rome series, and it's like 4 one-hour episodes, and it's really cool. Everything she does is cool. She's brilliant. And finally, by the final episode, you catch her walking around the streets of Jerusalem. And at one point, the camera fixates on a sign that says something in Hebrew and says something in Arabic. And then in letters that I'm literate for, it says, Via Dolorosa, the grief-stricken way, otherwise known as Sad Street. Yes, and I was reminded, and I started talking to Agnes about it too. And Mary Beard was going in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and people were crying and rolling on the ground and laying their face against some concrete slab or something. And I looked at Agnes and I said, "You know why this is?" She goes, "Oh no. Why?" Yeah, Agnes knows. When she can tell. It'll be almost 25 years. It's almost 25 years we've been married. It'll be 25 years a month from Sunday. She goes, "No, Bob, tell me." And I said, "Well, we've got all this Via Dolorosa and Stations of the Cross and Way of the Passion and all of this stuff because of tourism." "What?" "Yeah, because of tourism." because in that particular part of the episode, Mary Beard was talking about Constantine adopting Christianity as the state religion of Rome. And I said, well, yeah. Constantine's mama bore him when she was pretty young. She was like one of those teen moms that we spend so much time worrying about here in the modern era. And her name was Helen, or Elena. And she was kind of like a little league mom, constantly trying to tell Constantine how to do his job, how to be the emperor, and he didn't want to just, like, you know, kill her. I mean, he didn't hate her. Nero killed his own mother. And he wasn't like that, and he had just consolidated power, and he'd won the Battle of the Mulvian Bridge, and I don't know who the famous Roman named Mulva was that they named that after, but anyway, he'd consolidated power to become sole ruler of the Roman Empire, and, you know, Mama Helen was sitting there, and he said, Mom, I got an idea. I got a job for you. Only you can do this, Mom. Yes, son. What would that be? And he says, well, Mom, you know, I've just made Christianity the official religion of our empire. Yes, I know. I'm a Christian. Oh, yes, I know, Mother. You tell me about it all the time. And, well, Mom, we need to make sure that people who want to be Christians know where all this stuff happened, because, you know, the New Testament isn't really fully formed at this point in time, and various orthodoxies and heresies are competing for what will be the true religion. You know, Constantine didn't even bother getting baptized till the very last minute. Okay, do me. And because, you know, it's like W.C. Fields said, looking for a loophole. And so he said, Mom, what I want you to do, I'm going to send you over. I'm going to send you over to Palestine, because that's what the Romans called it, Palestine. They didn't call it Israel or anything. They called it Palestine back then. Mom, and so everybody there was a Palestinian. Mom, I'm going to send you over to Palestine. Don't worry, you've got an expense account. Spend what you want. But I want you to do some on the ground work, Mom. I want you to identify all the really important places that are important to these Christers. What are we? Christians, that's it. Yeah, right. I want you to find out. And so Helen becomes the first Christian tourist. And she goes over into the Middle East, what we know as the Middle East. It was the Near East to them. And she starts asking questions. Well, can you show me where Jesus was born? And like 90 different guys stick their hands out and go, oh, yeah, I can show you where Jesus was born. I mean, here, it'll only cost you a few denarii and a sesterce or two. And so she starts doling out the money. Maybe it's not the Via Dolorosa, but the Via Dola Buxo. And over here, lady. Yeah, come here. Oh, look. Here's your Church of the Nativity, right here in downtown Bethlehem. Absolutely. You got to see it to believe it. Oh, fascinating. Hey, lady. You want to buy a hunk of the true cross? What? The true cross that our Lord hung up on and died for our sins, we think, depending on which heresy one believes in, and if one's a Gnostic or not, that true cross, the very one, I can let you have it for cheap. Really? Yeah. How much? A couple of talents of silver, and it's yours. I'll take it. Hey, Sam. Etge Ime and Ubi Orfe and Ute I by Orfe Lankpe. Get it? Yeah, right here. Got your true cross. Well, what about where they buried him and he rose from the dead? Oh, right over here, lady. And while the ancient world had its fair share of pilgrimages prior to Christianity, I mean, in the Greek world, maybe you would maybe you'd take a trip to the Delphic Oracle on the island of Delphos, or maybe you'd like to go and see the games at the fields up on Mount Olympus. Or you might take a 1 week mini vacation over to see the ruins of ancient Troy. The Romans were particularly fond of Troy. They felt like they had a direct relationship to Troy. They didn't want to be Greek. Most of their culture they bogarted off the Greeks. So they wanted to say, no, we're Trojans. We, Aeneas carrying his old pappy out of the ruins, smoking ruins of Troy and all of that. And so they'd go, but for the first time, well, let's put it this way. Jerusalem becomes the world's first theme park. Because everything that happens with the Passion of Jesus, there was some hustler, some huckster, some grifter, and you know, along the way, probably hustling, you know, nutritional supplements. Hey, look here, I got a little vial of the mixed up sweat and grease and filth that we scraped off a gladiator. Lady, if you rub it on your breasts, it'll make you horny as a goat. And you'll be irresistible to other men. Never mind wondering about why it is that grimy man sweat oil would make a guy want a woman who rubbed it on her. And well, you know, it was a less judgmental time and far more credulous. Probably need to get the folks over at Horn Nutraceuticals working on some grimy olive oil sweat. And oh, by God, we could probably make a fortune. But really, Jerusalem becomes the world's first theme park. You know, you come around a corner and these little kids pop up and singing, "It's a crucifixion after all. It's a crucifixion after all." Really, the idea of the theme park comes from Jerusalem. Because it was one great big way to separate the credulous Christians from their money. And that is what we celebrate. A hustle. A con. And so, they turned the slaughter of an innocent man into a money-making operation. And we think Adam Smith invented capitalism. Pshaw. Yeah. So it's Good Friday. Although I'm still pretty sure that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi who wore a dress every day of his life, wouldn't think it was so good. Hey, stop that, it hurts. Peter, yes, Lord, I can see your house from up here. Lots of great Easter jokes out there. But, you know, why doesn't Jesus eat M&Ms? They fall through the holes in his hands. But we'll let that go. But this is a particularly superstitious time of year for Christians. It's the central tenet, as well as Christmas, the idea that a person can be born from parthenogenesis, and then having been rendered dead, can come back and be a zombie savior. Yeah, happy Easter, y'all. I missed Maudlin Thursday, so I wanted to make sure I didn't miss the this big day. Food porn, you know, Easter is Sunday, April Fool's Day. We're gonna kill the fatted lamb and roast it, and everybody comes on over. April Fools, here's a potato chip. Yeah, but that's like I said, lamb. Are you kidding me? It would be nice, but it's just Agnes and me, so. I don't think Agnes and I could rip through a whole lamb. Probably not even a whole leg of lamb. Maybe I'll, no. I don't know. It'd be kind of nice to do up some, marinate some lamb cubes. I had a lovely email the other night. That had sort of a recipe. Ellen wrote in, and she said, "Hearing you talk," and this is when I was talking with good Todd down in South Carolina, Stan Barbecue Todd. Ellen wrote in a couple of nights ago and said, "Hearing you talk about lamb, I grew up where lamb was cheaper than beef, and my grandparents would buy a lamb for the freezer. My favorite recipe for leg of lamb is my take of my grandmother's. Takes a couple of days marinating in olive oil, garlic, lemon, more garlic, rosemary, and garlic, and then cooking on a rotisserie. The aroma of that cooking lamb combined with the sound of sizzling deliciousness and creaking rotisserie spindle, dot, dot, dot." Yeah, that's the third or fourth time I've read that email, and I salivate every time. So thanks for that, Ellen. It'd be kind of, yeah, That'd be kind of pleasant. Oh, I don't know. You know, maybe that $502 million Mega Millions will hit tonight, and I'll go and buy a leg of lamb. And chunk it and cube it and make. That would be tasty, especially with the homemade tzatziki. Can you still hear the lambs, Clarice? Arthur with a note. Get your tunics here. Get your tunics. Get the authentic Christ tunic worn by the Savior himself. His Father bless him. You can't go home without a Christ tunic. Novelty tunics also available. Jeez me? No, Jesus. And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah. Oh, by the way, I had a nice note from our buddy Tom in the Bay Area. Even before I saw this email, it was kind of interesting. I noticed that the wallpaper for my Windows 10 on the Fab machine here had stopped. It, for the longest time, it looked like it was I think it was one of those mountain lakes, those alpine lakes down in far Patagonia. No, not the clothing company, Patagonia, the place down way the hell down in Chile, or, well, you know, it's all relative in space. Maybe it's way up in Chile. Beautiful place, though. But for reasons, and maybe it's why we suddenly had sound problems earlier, for reasons that otherwise escape me, the wallpaper changed on Windows 10. And it was funny because last night Jim and I were talking about, you know, my sailboat that I'm going to buy if we hit the lottery. And don't worry, we'll still have the horn. I'll just be broadcasting from some little island somewhere or some anchorage near some little island in the Caribbean. It'll be cool. And there won't be any more fundraising either. Won't that be nice? But lo and behold, I was thinking of Tom earlier out there in the Bay Area because my wallpaper changed to this overhead shot, probably by a drone, of what looks to be maybe a, 38, 43, 46, Omaha, foot sailboat in some little cove of some barren-looking island. And it was beautiful. And it just made the Christopher Cross start playing right there inside my noggin. Mm-hmm. Oh, the canvas can be wonderful, beautiful things. No more singing. But anyway, I got a note from Tom. Subject line, word gets around. Hey, Bob, I was driving past a train of heavily graffitied car carriers today and about choked when I saw one that said in 6-foot-high letters, Gump Trump. I think it was only a few weeks ago you were saying that. I just love the thought of that rolling across the country. Also, it occurred to me that when saying something about T. Rump's widely dispersed fatherhood, we should always say that he has 5 children, and this is important because it's in bold, that we know of, by 3 different women. Can't hurt to sow a little extra doubt, after all. And Tom then adds, I've been a little scarce lately on the fundraising, but today I'll put in the mail 100 clams. Maybe it'd make a good challenge for Monday, the Gump Trump Challenge. Consider that on the table for Monday, then. For Monday, not this evening, for Monday. Maybe be thinking about it over the holiday weekend. Thanks, Tom. Thanks very kindly. I don't know if you've got a Windows 10 machine, but let me know if that wallpaper with the sailboat shows up, because, whew, oh, it just grabbed me and took me for a ride. Meanwhile, a note coming in from Lee in New York City. Subject line, April Fool's Day. I'm not a person who likes to embarrass someone because it happens to be the first day of the 4th month, but I still like the harmless prank from Candid Camera's Alan Funt. Make a sign that reads, dry paint. Put it on a wall. Watch people go to the wall and check that the paint is really dry. Oh, that's good. Dry paint. Or, I don't know, maybe Sunday would be a good time to circulate that petition again, calling for the banning of dihydrous oxide. You know, H2O, water. Mm-hmm. What? Ron in Raleigh tells me, could you spare a few dinars? I'm a little light this month. By the way, you mispronounced tzatziki. Okay. P.S. I'm a word knower as well. Well, I know you are a word knower. I gotta click this link though and find out what I'm getting wrong here. Oh, it's a listen to. Okay, well, hold on a damn minute. Let's turn it up and see if we can all hear it.
tzatziki, tzatziki.
You getting that?
Tzatziki, tzatziki.
I didn't know I was saying it that far different from that. Tzatziki. I guess it's got a... Or what are we saying? That it's got a silent T or something? Okay. Damn it, I hate it when I mispronounce things. Mispronunciate. Meanwhile, Steve, a member of the fraternity of Steve, a more nefarious joke, a petition to end the universal suffrage of all people. I don't find that particularly funny, and I think portions of our government are working on that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Clarity. Don't tell me how to listen, Bob. You people. Meanwhile, Robert in Australia says, it's a trifecta. It's going to be fun tomorrow. Well, see, because today is already tomorrow in Australia. So tomorrow for Robert will be April 1st. For us, it'll be the 31st. And God only knows what day it'll be for you if you're listening to the podcast. Believe me, modern broadcasting gets so confusing. It's going to be fun tomorrow, says Robert. It's April 1st, daylight savings time ends, and it's Easter Sunday, and some people will forget at least one of those. Oh, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. That is not going to be the bumper, by the way. Note coming in from Les with a little cartoon. Regarding Good Friday, probably what Jesus really said, a cartoon, guy up on a cross hollering, I'll get you for this, you sons of bitches. I'll kill you all. Wouldn't blame him if he had. Or you can always just go for the Daffy Duck response. Thanks for the sour persimmons, brother. Because there is something about vinegar along the way. Oh, see, now you're hurting me. Now you're hurting me, James. Sailboat, you can find a slip real close to San Francisco for less than $500 a month. I was paying $360 for a 32-foot slip in Emeryville in 2005. Can't imagine it's that much more right now. Right next to the Bay Bridge, 15 minutes to downtown San Francisco. Oh. We've got a crisis here. Ron and Raleigh just wrote in, subject line, why? Everyone else has a fraternity, but the Rons get short shrift. Well, I'm sorry, there's only two of you that I'm aware of. Oh, okay, well, I mean, there's three. No, two. You want a fraternity, Ron? You're going to have to go out and get some pledges, okay? Bring back a couple of more Rons, have them start writing emails, and it's not just all on you. I mean, Ron in the far frozen north, it needs to do some too, but you can't have a fraternity of two. You just can't. I mean, we got a couple of Todds, you don't have them writing in and agitating and stuff. No. Oh, and thought you might find this interesting. Over at Bloomberg, this was an interesting read today. Bloomberg Business Week, reporting by Zeke Fox, F-A-U-X, Foe, Zeke Foe. Is this an April Fool's joke? I don't think so, because it was datelined yesterday. No, it was datelined the 27th. But this is very interesting. How Facebook helps shady advertisers pollute the internet. Oh, by the way, I think you've just been, Ron, I think you've just been politely told to suffer quietly. Silent R. Lamar says, if Ron has a problem, think of me. Silent R. Lamar's. We don't exactly have a Silent R fraternity now, do we? Although for you, Silent R, we'll add Silent R's to a lot of other people, and like we could have Silent R. Anatole. Or, you know, Silent R. Bob. No, that's just going to get too confusing. I was waiting for one of these, Robert in Australia. I'm Brian, and so's my wife. Speaking of which, did you ever notice the Emperor Hadrian, his portrait bust, his Roman portrait bust? Did you ever notice the Emperor Hadrian looks a lot like Graham Chapman from Monty Python? Yeah, pity he had to up and die. Meanwhile, the questions now have begun to roll right in. Subject line fraternities coming in from Lee. Hey, Bob, out of curiosity, how many Lees do you know? I'll bet it's not many. Well, now that you mention it, we'll probably have a whole passel of Lees, and for that matter, given what Ron started, a whole passel of Ron's riding in. You know, Ron, you're not getting any sympathy at all. Until you find another Laurel, can I be the official horn oracle? Oh, okay. Well, all right. That makes all right. Billable Rick has put it all to rest. Bob, stop telling us how to form our own fraternities. Yeah. Anyway, how Facebook helps shady advertisers pollute the internet. The subhead on it is in quotation marks. They go out and find the morons for me. The illustration that goes with it has a finger. It might very well be Mickey Mouse's finger because there's like a glove. But it's a finger about to touch a screen with a pill bottle and a lid on it. And the label on the pill bottle says IQ. And it starts out as a story about the reporter describes as a Davos for digital hucksters. And this last one took place in Berlin at a renovated 19th century train station. All the most popular hustles were there. Miracle diet pills, instant muscle builders, brain boosters, male enhancers. The U1 and iPhone companies had display booths, and the Your Computer May Be Infected folks sent salesmen. Russia was represented by the promoters of a black mask face peel, and Canada made a showing with bot-infested dating sites. They'd come to mingle with thousands of affiliate marketers, middlemen who buy online ad space in bulk, run their campaigns, and earn commissions for each sale they generate. Affiliates promote some legitimate businesses, such as Amazon.com and eBay, but they're also behind many of the shady and misleading ads that pollute Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the rest of the internet. The top affiliates assemble a few times a year to learn the latest schemes and trade tips about gaming the rules set by social networks and search platforms. They think of themselves as kin to the surfers slash bank robbers of the 1991 movie Point Break. Just more materialistic, jetting from nightclub to Lamborghini race while staying a step ahead of the authorities. Now, you may see these ads on social media and say to yourself, I wonder what kind of simpleton clicks on that or orders that. Well, one San Diego crew took in $179 million before they got busted last year by the Federal Trade Commission for violating three laws governing online conduct. The whole conference was sponsored by an outfit called Stack That Money, and we don't think about these things. But it has translated to billions upon billions of dollars for Facebook, and in turn, millions and millions of dollars for these hustlers and hucksters. After the show, the convention, Facebook representatives flew to Ibiza on a plane rented by Stack That Money to party with some some of the top affiliates. Yeah. Granted anonymity, affiliates were happy to detail their tricks. They told me that Facebook had revolutionized scamming. The company built tools with its trove of user data that made it the go-to platform for big brands. Affiliates hijacked them. Facebook's targeting algorithm is so powerful, they said, they don't need to identify suckers themselves. Facebook does it automatically. And they boasted that Russia's... this is a good one. They boasted that Russia's disinformatia agents were using tactics their community had pioneered. The article is also the story of a Pole by the name of Robert Grin. He's a superstar in the online hustling business. And he's one of the at an estimated net worth of $180 million and 31 years old. He's one of the wealthiest men in Poland. And he's made it all off of sketchy ads on the internet and particularly on Facebook. Because what he did is he wrote some software that helps these scammers make sure that Facebook doesn't catch them in their scams. Now get this, and you wonder why I spend so much time telling people about things like Blandiloquus Bloodwort from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Have you tried Blandiloquus Bloodwort? Yeah? A maker of bogus diet pills wants to sell them for $100 a month and doesn't care how it's done. The pill vendor approaches a broker called an affiliate network and offers to pay a $60 commission per sign-up. Okay. The network spreads the word to affiliates who design ads and pay to place them on Facebook and other places in hopes of earning the commissions. The affiliate takes a risk, paying to run ads without knowing if they'll work, but if even a small percentage of the people who see them become buyers, the profits can be huge. And here's the real Lulu of a paragraph. Affiliates once had to guess what kind of person might fall for their unsophisticated cons, targeting ads by age, geography, or interests. Now Facebook does that work for them. The social network tracks who clicks on the ad and who buys the pills, and then starts targeting others whom its algorithm thinks are likely to buy. Affiliates describe watching their ad campaigns lose money for a few days as Facebook gathers data through trial and error, then seeing the sales take off exponentially. Quote, "They go out and find the morons for me," I was told by an affiliate who sells deceptively priced skincare creams with fake endorsements from Chelsea Clinton. Ah, yes, the celebrity endorsement. I've never cared much for Super Beats, but thanks to Super Beats. And now it comes with a clean, ergonomic grip. Yeah. Meanwhile, the Robert Grin... his software allows affiliates to tailor the content they deliver according to a number of factors, including the location or IP address associated with the user. The feature is useful for ad targeting, for example, showing Spanish speakers a message in their native language. But it's also a simple matter to identify the addresses of Facebook's ad reviewers and program campaigns to show them, and only them, harmless content. And even if Facebook catches you, you just set up a nice, clean, new Facebook account, and away you go again, and the money just rolls right in. So maybe, if it works as intended, you'll take these Horn Nutraceuticals ads and they'll just remind you of exactly what's behind the crap that gets hustled all around you. And, you know, I'm funny this way. I can't help but notice this stuff. One of the latest ones being an ad that's running in the midst of that program, that I have a nasty habit of watching in the morning. This is three mornings in a row that, by the way, that Mika has shown up looking like she's trying to cover up a black eye. No idea, but, you know, Agnes noticed and said, what the hell's wrong with her eye? And it wasn't like she had that, you know, Sarah Hustlebuck Sanders, one eye wide open, one eye half shut, sort of sanctuary look about her. No, it looked like she had a shiner, a car wreck or something like that. I don't know. But 3 days in a row, it's just kind of strange. Agnes took photos. But the latest one is, there's some Jillian something or another who pitches, she was some sort of weight training, exercise coach, and she was famous for being really horrible to people. She was Gordon Ramsay before Gordon Ramsay was Gordon Ramsay. And she said, yeah, I've mellowed over the years, and I've found a way to beat my addiction to sugary drinks. And that's when my pink little ears went, bing! Addiction to sugary drinks. Man, you want to talk about some tone-deaf marketing? SodaStream, you are tone-deaf. You're advertising in a country that is eaten alive by opioids. Chances are, every time your ad airs somewhere, somebody is seeing that who knows or cared about somebody who actually died as a result of opioid addiction, and you've got ad copy talking about my addiction to sugary drinks. I wouldn't buy SodaStream if you gave me the money to buy it with, for that reason and that reason only.
My addiction to sugary drinks. Now I just press the button on my SodaStream and I squeeze a little lemon in it and I'm happy. Of course, those other people who died of real addictions, I guess they're not so happy.
Yeah. That one in the DirecTV domestic violence ad. You've probably seen this one. It's not just airing over on that program in the morning. There's a woman who's there's a guy down on the sidewalk, and she's throwing shit at him out of a window. She's thrown a suitcase. She's thrown a guitar at him. She's thrown a set-top cable box at him. And he's down there just ducking. And I guess we're supposed to think that that's funny or cute. But nobody who's ever been through domestic violence does. And gender doesn't matter in this situation. Domestic violence is a deadly, serious issue in this country. I don't know. Maybe DirecTV Now's next commercial will feature her standing up there in that second story, that second story apartment, with an AR-15 taking pot shots at the guy. Would DirecTV Now ever dare have it be the woman standing on the sidewalk and the guy throwing stuff at her? No, they would know better than to do that. But, well, it's funny this way. Right? So, you know, we're surrounded by this stuff, and I guess it just sort of plays like the background music of our lives. But, there's some stuff that just isn't particularly funny. You know, as Laura Ingraham, for instance, found out. She thought she was going to troll David Hogg and made fun of him on Twitter. And he ate her lunch. Half of her advertising revenue is gone now. And then, to make matters worse, she tried to climb up on Yeshua's back and ride him, ride him all the way to the cross, you know, with Holy Week to remind me, I shouldn't have said what I said. And of course, she only apologized after she started hemorrhaging advertisers. Because we know what the real, you know, what really, really matters. Okay, then, a couple of notes. Note from Ron and Raleigh, subject line, all these other folks are one-offs. We Rons, we happy few, are a multiple. By the way, did you hear that the Oompa Loompa in chief says that Amazon isn't paying enough taxes? I saw that, yeah. This from the guy that's still running that, I'm being audited, I can't release my returns. This after over a year. In regard to SodaStream, Ron and Raleigh continues, I won't buy a SodaStream because it's made in Israel. Well, that's a pretty good reason, too. Maybe it's because they're a foreign company. They don't understand that making fun of addiction is something maybe you ought not do in America anymore. Lee in New York, however, says, subject line addiction. Real addiction is a serious problem. It has horrific consequences. But the humor of this refrigerator magnet made me buy it for my wife. I could give up chocolate, but I'm not a quitter. Well, see, that's not an addiction joke. That's just funny. Subject line, NRA, Silent R. Lamar says, the commercial we should see would show Wayne the Peter running from an AK-47. I know, not funny. Now, that'd be hilarious. And so, even though I got a little bit of a late start, it's time to, that's the filibobster. And I've got, it's time to fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. And so we will take a little break. Again, a reminder, if you have never participated in the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, that is Friday on the front porch, well, what you need to do is send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Sparky Dunk. And he'll scatter the breadcrumbs out in front of you, and there's a little string just like Theseus trying to remember his path back away through the labyrinth, away from the Minotaur, and I guess that makes me the Minotaur. Well, I don't know. There are those who would say I am half bull, but you get the idea. So, yeah, break time, and then a conversation unlike any other. Right here on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yeah, 10cc with a highly appropriate bumper there, the Wall Street Shuffle. And it is 19 minutes past the hour. Let's fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, a conversation unlike any other. Hey, Sparky.
Yo, Bob.
Yo, I'm loving your Super Beats container there, man.
You had to ask right off.
Well, I mean, I hadn't seen
that,
it before.
That's just to show Steve that he won the bet.
Ah, what bet? Oh, that bet.
To guess the caller.
Yeah,
bet.
Yeah, right, yeah. Oh, so he wins a free month supply of Super Beats?
He has to send me his address to get it.
Well, are you gonna send him the little credulity strips too? I mean, it'd be a shame if it was full of fake super beats.
No, it's not fake. It's a real jar.
Yes.
It's kicking around here for years and years and years, but it's a real jar.
Is it plastic or? I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it looks like they didn't sink a whole lot into the graphics for the labeling.
No.
The Circulation Superfood.
Mm-hmm. Serving. It's something my mom bought once upon a time.
Yep. Probably hustling him on Fox, right?
I guess.
Yep.
Since they were avid Fox viewers, I mean, they were brainwashed past recognition.
And so,
other than that, today I've been weed eating.
Yeah, I was going to say, you said it was in the chat room, it says it's Weed Eater Friday in 80-degree weather.
Yeah, it's 83 in here in the man cave right now.
Our brief flirtation with spring ended this morning. It's 60 here in the studio now.
The almond trees are trying to bloom, but they're really pitiful this year.
Well, tomorrow we're supposed to get all the way up to 63 with a low of 45. But Easter Sunday, yeah, all those good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual Christians, they're going to get rained on with a high of 48. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe if their God loved them, he wouldn't make that happen. But, oh, well.
Yeah, but it was a nice enough day. I had to get it weed-eated so I could play Grady Gopher Hole Golf.
Gopher Hole Golf?
Yeah. Grady made his own golf course out there at Diggins. So I've got an old putter that somewhere my dad got from somewhere, a golf club putter. And we got a ball that came over the fence from the neighbors next door, a cool ball. And you hit it with the golf club and you try to get it in one of Grady's gopher holes. Now, if his head goes all the way in, you get 10 points. If it's a deep hole.
What if it doesn't go all the way?
If just his snout or just his nose, I mean, if the ball disappears anyway, but it's all gauged on what his head does. So if he just has to reach in just a little bit and get the ball, it's a one. Now, if the snout goes up in, you get like a five or something.
What's par? How many holes?
Oh, there's about 10 holes, but they're all clumped together.
Oh, well,
it's a strange game.
It sounds every bit as enjoyable as cornhole. So you know.
Yeah.
You could always throw beanbags at it.
Not from the man cave.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I could throw a beanbag that far.
Oh, so the man cave is the tee box? Is that it?
Yeah. Inside the man cave with the north door open, and you hit the ball, you're at an angle. You go over to the north door till you can see Mount Lassen, and then you can shoot. I mean, that's where you tee off from.
Right, you know, right, I can imagine
almost,
that
almost right parallel to the dartboard line that's here at the north end.
You know, I can imagine that this is probably how golf originated. Something similar.
Yeah, but the Scottish didn't have green bud back then, did they?
Oh, is there, does this sport involve performance enhancement?
No, it's not performance enhancement. It's just mind enhancement.
Yeah, it sounds like a performance enhancement.
You got to be in the mood. You got to be the ball, you know?
Oh, right. Be the ball, Danny. Be the ball. Oh, it's in the lumberyard. And, of course, everyone who's never watched Caddyshack is going, what the hell are they talking about now? Well, let's go over and check in with Billable Rick. We've had lots of fun legal issues over the course of the week. Hey, Rick.
Hey, how's it going, Bob?
It's going. It's a great day to be a West Virginian, I can tell you that.
It's always a great day to be a West Virginian, Bob.
Damn straight. Be a little bit greater if we were in the Final Four, but you can't have everything.
Well, let's hope that Loyola Chicago at least gets to the finals. You know, they might. I wouldn't be surprised if they beat Michigan.
I'm afraid I'll jinx them, but I really want them to beat Michigan. Want them to beat Michigan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I will never, ever forgive John Beilein.
And why is that?
Well, because after Michigan came down and poached Rich Rodriguez and Big Hair Rita for the football team, they then came down and poached John Beilein for the basketball team.
Ah, okay. Well, you guys have Bob Huggins, though. He's an excellent coach.
Oh, yeah. Huggs is great. I mean, that's mm-hmm. not the thing. It's the
dirty pool.
Yeah, it's that. It's the poaching by Michigan, and it's also the Beilein was nobody till West Virginia hired him.
Mm.
And his loyalty extended exactly as far as the moment that they showed him the paper with the salary on it, and then gone.
Right. Yeah. Well, what can you do?
One minute he's singing, it's West Virginia, the pride of every mountaineer, and boom, Michigan fight song.
Amazing. Well, hard to turn down a job from a, school in the Big Ten, with a good basketball tradition. Not great, but good, Ohio State would be better, or Michigan State would be better, but,
Well, Michigan State has its own issues right now.
Oh, geez. Yeah. They do what? Half of the team are criminals? Is that it?
No, the whole sexual abuse the thing with the Dr. Nasser
Dr. Nasser, yeah. Ah, oh, jeez, that's just disgusting. It makes you think of the Olympics in a whole different light now, doesn't it, Bob?
Well, yeah. I've never thought of the Olympics in a particularly good light in the first place, but
right. Well. I used to, but, not so much anymore. It's just all about making money. It's commercialism, That's all it is.
The whole world over, Billable Rick. The whole world over.
You got it. So what are all these legal issues that you're wondering about, Bob?
Oh, I'm not wondering. I mean, I don't know if you caught the podcast or anything, but just the business with Stormy and.
Oh yeah.
The various lawsuits and the fact that the motion to depose Geezer Disgustus was denied as being premature, which it probably is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you don't get to take discovery usually until, at least in federal practice, until an answer is due. So, I mean, you can serve discovery at the same time you serve a summons and complaint, but I don't think you can require responses until,
Yeah, because, they could come in and admit everything in the complaint, and then why do you need to do discovery?
Right, exactly.
I mean, Trump could come in he could come in and essentially agree that she can tell her story and waive the non-disclosure agreement, and that suit's dead, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Yeah,
he could do what he does in every other piece of litigation: fold like a cheap suit.
Yeah, yeah.
and no, really, if you're his counsel, wouldn't you maybe think about doing that?
Yeah, I think I would. In terms of he's kept the story alive by fighting it, by fighting the lawsuit. She's already gotten her story out. So,
and the $130,000 is already gone.
Right.
And you don't really want to litigate. You're not really litigating it so much as giving Bob Mueller something else to look at.
Right. That's true. Well, Mueller's going to have something else to look at regardless of what you do in the litigation, you know, because of the fact that, you know, you have this payment, 11 days before the election, you know, by your attorney, supposedly. So how is that not a in-kind campaign contribution, you know?
Right, but the longer you stir it, the more it stinks.
Absolutely. And also it makes him look mean-spirited to go after this, you know, person for, let's say, $20 million is, I think, the demand I've heard. Not that they'll ever get that, but, I mean, I think the most they would get in arbitration would be $1 million.
She could, let's say they got the 20 mil. She could bankrupt that day before yesterday, couldn't she?
She could file a bankruptcy petition, and would that be dischargeable? I suppose so, as long as there was nothing recorded, you know, if the judgment wasn't recorded where she lives to attach to her assets, you know?
Because, one of the things that's out there is that, in fact, senior White House staff, okay, we're not talking about porn stars or playmates or anything.
Mm-hmm.
First thing that happened was Trump's people put a non-disclosure agreement in front of senior White House staff, making it a penalty, subjecting them to the penalties if they said anything about their service in the Trump White House.
Yeah, which is totally ridiculous because they don't work at, while Trump can fire them, you know, they're government employees. I mean, he's not the employer. He's just, you know, the supervisor.
Right. And he does not have the legal power to, aren't those unenforceable?
Of course they are. But the idea is to intimidate people into silence. And it really hasn't worked so well based on the number of leaks that are coming out of this White House. I mean, it basically, you know, resembles a, one of those old boats you find that have sunk to the bottom of a fjord or something like that, you know, Bob?
And it's filled with shit?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Well, that reminds me of, I mentioned this the other night, and maybe I'm wrong. I could be. It's happened more than once. But I remember way back in contracts class, you know, first semester of first year.
Mm-hmm.
When they teach you a little something about something called liquidated damages clauses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in contracts, a liquidated damage clause isn't it generally frowned upon by the courts in enforcement actions, especially if the liquidated damage clause serves primarily as a penalty?
Yeah.
Isn't that the rule?
Yeah. That's more or less the case. Yeah. A liquidated damage, the idea behind it is, if a contract is breached, it might be difficult to determine what the exact amount of the damages are. So the parties agree that, you know, for purposes of a breach, this is the amount of the deemed damages. But again, she only got paid, you know, 130 grand. How can the liquidated damages for a disclosure of the in violation of a non-disclosure agreement amount to $1 million of damages? You know what I'm saying?
Right. In other words, it serves as a penalty.
Right. Right.
And so wouldn't you expect a court of competent jurisdiction to look at that and go, no, we got about 500 years worth of contracts law that says that ain't going to happen.
Well, the problem you have, Bob, is that a court of competent jurisdiction may not look at that because Trump's going to try to get this back into private arbitration, and this based on Supreme Court precedents, there's a pretty good chance that it'll go back to arbitration because arbitration clauses are enforced even against, let's say, consumers. Even against private parties, non-corporate parties, And you know, it's the what I think it's the Arbitration Act of 1823 or no 1923 that is basically the law that's enforced. So you know, the problem is the court of competent jurisdiction may not look at the amount of the deemed liquidated damages of $1 million for a violation. And, you know, they may not look at whether that's reasonable or not. They may just say, okay, you're entitled to $1 million, Trump. Here you go. You know, and issue a judgment.
So now, help me here. Because mm-hmm. Where arbitration is concerned, the law just goes out the window. And the arbitrator can pretty much make it up as she goes along?
Well, the arbitrator is supposed to enforce the law of whatever jurisdiction is agreed to as the applicable law in the case. I think here it's California law, if I'm not mistaken, under this agreement
David Dennison.
Yeah, DD and Stormy. So the judge is required to apply the law of the state that, you know, the choice of law that's been chosen in the contract. And yeah, I mean, I think in some cases you can appeal arbitration awards to an actual court of competent jurisdiction, like I think it would go to a district court if you know, it's kind of surprising, but there was some telecom litigation that I was kind of tangentially involved in, and there was an arbitration award entered, and it was then confirmed, I guess, by the district court, and then it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit and was set aside. So I think all you can do with an arbitration award is either seek to have it confirmed or denied.
So when let's say a district court reviews an arbitration award,
yeah,
is the standard of review, abuse of discretion or clear error or, I mean, what?
I think that would depend on the theory on which you're appealing the arbitration award. If it's a question of, you know, whether you know, the amount of liquidated damages in this contract is reasonable or not, you know, does it shock the conscience or whatever? Is it punitive as opposed to compensatory? You know, that might be a question of law, you know, or it might be a mixed question of law and fact, in which case, you know, if it's just a question of law, you'd look at that with a new slate or de novo. Okay. There would be no deference accorded to the arbitrator's decision, as far as, you know, to the extent it involves an interpretation of the law, there would be no deference necessarily accorded to the arbitrator. If it's a question of fact, then yeah, the clearly erroneous standard applies. Or if it's a question of you know, whether the judge exercised his or her discretion in an improper manner, that would be abuse of discretion. You know, lots of times evidentiary rulings are reviewed for abuse of discretion, for example.
Right. Okay.
So you know, I'm not, you know, in some cases, you know, I'd have to look at the agreement between Trump and DD, David Dennison.
Okay, so but, okay, so back to David Dennison for a minute.
Yeah.
How do you in an arbitration situation, do you not have to prove who the parties are? I mean, can some good old boy from under the bridge, you know, with the screw top wine still on his breath, can he walk in and go, "Yeah, I'm David Dennison"?
No, I mean, I think you have to unmask yourself in order to avail yourself of the arbitration remedy.
And so with the arbitration itself, and I don't know, maybe these are all, maybe every arbitration is different. Maybe it's all ad hoc. But mm-hmm. if it is subject to any kind of judicial review, mm-hmm. doesn't that mean there has to be a record?
Yeah, there is oftentimes in arbitrations. Yes, you have court reporters and everything. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. So when the lawyers come in Somebody's going to have to say, well, yes, you're arbitrationist. My client is a liar. My client claimed to operate under a name that is not his own. It was we will henceforth refer to him as Donald J. Trump, a.k.a. David Dennison. Mm-hmm. Would that show up in the record?
I'd like to think it would. Yeah, I'd like to think it would. The arbitrator in this case is a retired Los Angeles Superior Court judge. Apparently, she has a pretty decent reputation. And so, I mean, there's no way the federal judge is going to want to keep this case, Bob.
Do the rules of evidence apply?
I think so. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it would be the rules of the California rules of evidence that would apply, whatever the forum, you know, state's rules are, you know, whatever the choice of law has been determined.
I'm just trying to, because this is, and I know this is a complicated highfalutin legal term. This is a mess.
Yeah, it's a hot mess, Bob, to be more precise.
And in many ways, it's a hot mess of Donald Trump's own making.
Oh, sure. I mean, his whole life is a hot mess, Bob. You know?
So, I mean, I'm struggling here. At what point in time did some lawyer tell him that any of this was a good idea, or was it a case of him saying, no, I want it, I've got to have it, I will have it, this is what I hired you to do, do it?
You mean the non-disclosure agreement?
Yeah, I mean, because if she's just some woman out in the middle of nowhere
mm-hmm.
who says, I had sex with Donald Trump, then it's strictly he said and she said.
Mm-hmm.
But what protection does this? I mean, I get non-disclosure agreements. I understand non-compete clauses. Okay,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are reasons to have them.
Right.
You know, if you work at 3M and you invent the Post-it note, and then you quit your job and you take a job with, I don't know, 4N. And you mm-hmm. say, I've got the Post-it note here, and, you know, I invented it. Well, there's a reason 3M wants to protect itself via a non-disclosure and a non-compete clause. And it's a valid right. reason.
Right.
Where's right. the argument for the valid need to do this? I mean, the fact that he obsessively does this, you know, in that Washington Post story, he walks into the room and says, okay, has everybody signed their agreements like we did back during the campaign? Or if you were part of the team at Trump Towers, everybody signed them now? And the article makes clear that Reince Priebus had finally acquiesced in the demand that these things be created and signed, almost solely on the determination that the damn things would never be enforceable in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, where's the advantage?
Well, I think that clearly there's a difference between the non-disclosure agreement signed by public employees, government employees in the White House, and Stormy. I mean, clearly the non-disclosure agreements give Trump absolutely no protection as regards the government employees, the White House staff. And that clearly, you know, he's not the employer. He has no, their duty is to uphold the Constitution of the United States, to serve the American people, et cetera, not an allegiance oath to Trump, although that's the way he looks at it, obviously. In the case of Stormy Daniels, I mean, you know, non-disclosure agreements are used all the time, and also in with regard to interpersonal relationships as well, you know. So, if it is for a illegal purpose, then that would be
you got ahead of me. That's where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have a non-disclosure agreement for something that was illegal?
I don't think so.
In consideration of the sum of $130,000 cash in hand paid, the sufficiency of which is hereby acknowledged, the party of the first part does hereby agree not to disclose that the party of the second part killed Cock Robin.
Right. Right. No, that clearly is against public policy. I can't imagine that kind of a non-disclosure agreement being upheld. The difficulty you have, Bob, is you have these secret private arbitrations, and there's no scrutiny. There's no reporters there. There's no, you know, it's not in the sunshine, so to speak, you know, so all sorts of crazy stuff can happen, especially since the party that seeks to enforce the arbitration agreement usually is the one paying the arbitrator. So, you know, like these banks, and, you know, like if you have a problem with your cell phone bill, like if I have Verizon, so if I had a problem with Verizon and, you know, I think they overcharged me to the extent of like $25, I couldn't, you know, I would have to go to an arbitration for that. And I also couldn't, you know, try to start a class action against Verizon for that unauthorized charge, because of the way the Supreme Court has ruled recently. Okay, so it gives big companies a huge advantage over the little guy. Getting back to the illegal purpose of the agreement, yeah, if it's clearly an illegal purpose, but if it's just to maintain secrecy, I don't know if that's necessarily an illegal purpose. If it, you know,
what if it's a fraud upon the court? What if what we're talking about here is actually, and again, I'm not, I just sit around thinking about this stuff because it occurred to me the other day, Rick, that this is the kind of lunatic bullshit that winds up on contracts exams at the end of your first semester.
Exactly. Yeah, it does.
You know, full of just obscure horse shit that nobody in their right mind would ever imagine actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
What if the $130,000 is a fraud upon the court, or a fraud upon the arbitrator in this case, insofar as it's actually payment for services rendered, and I don't mean silence.
Yes, for prostitution, meretricious services.
It's $130,000 paid for the illegal act in the state of California of prostitution.
Okay. Well, then all bets would be off as regards that. But the problem is, Bob, I mean, you know, hypothetically speaking, that would be a good argument for Stormy, but that's not the one she's made. She has admitted that this was consensual on her part, you know, that she went into the bathroom, came out of the bathroom, and Donnie was all undressed and on the edge of the bed, you know, waiting for her, basically, you know?
Well, right, but I mean, that's something she said on CNN. There was no, there were no oaths administered.
Right.
And she can, I mean, really? Her adversary in this process isn't exactly someone who is known for his truth telling.
No, yeah, right. Oh, jeez. I'd say that's an understatement of the day, Bob.
Well, thank you. I don't do understatement very often.
Do you give cowbells for?
No, we don't get cowbells for understatement. But
are we talking about cowbell inflation?
Exactly. We do not want to create. We don't want cowbell inflation, and we also do not want to have a cowbell gap.
There you go. Exactly. But
the purpose of this larger, the larger purpose of this conversation is to point out again, to use your phrase, what a hot steaming mess this is.
Absolutely, it is.
And there's nothing open and shut about it. And it would seem to me that if there are three doors in front of Donald Trump in this situation, two of them have man-eating tigers behind them.
That's a good analogy. I'd agree with that.
The third door has, it's the lady or the tiger. The third door has the lady behind it, and she's more dangerous than the two man-eating tigers.
Right, yeah, she's a lady who resembles that one of the characters in the Kill Bill series, played by Daryl Hannah. I forget her name. You remember that?
Yeah, indeed.
She had like a patch and stuff. Yeah, an eye patch. I'm trying to remember her name. Anyway, I'm sure a listener can chime in. But yeah, that's sort of the choices. Yeah, there's no good choices here for Trump. And again, he's really elevated this whole issue and kept it alive for a lot longer than it otherwise would have by being so damned litigious, you know?
And that also goes to his Atne Ute Aitbre, if you one what I een me ness. He never wins.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. He doesn't.
I mean, this guy could bet on losing and lose that bet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
Have you ever had a client that was that you would say was comp? I don't want you to disclose any confidences or anything, but have you ever had a client that was reminiscent of Trump? That no
Not
matter
at all.
You know,
no.
I mean, the guy comes in and you show him the billable contract, and I get 50,000 Cronkites for blinking.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit there and you pour out your heart and your soul and you worry at his problems, and you come back and say, you know, you're in luck because I'm fucking smart. I got this. And you lay it all out to him. And then he goes, oh, that's great. I love it. And then goes and does the exact opposite. Because that's pretty much the history of Donald Trump and lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the way back to Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn, about every 3 seconds out in eternity where he's in hell, he gets the backwards pineapple from Satan himself.
Oh, God.
But he becomes involved with Roy Cohn because he and his filthy old pappy, the Klansman, get busted by the federal government for engaging in racist leasing and renting and property management issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sue his ass under the Fair Housing Act and present him with a consent decree that basically says, I promise I won't do it anymore. Honestly, I won't. And all he has to do is sign it, and it goes the hell away. And instead, the dumbass goes out and hires Roy Cohn, lawyers up, spends a fortune on Roy Cohn, and gets himself in deeper shit than he ever could have dreamt of being in. So, I wonder what it, not that I, you know, not, but what does that feel like to be that lawyer? I mean, do you just keep looking at your watch going, well, you know, I'm racking up the billables here. Fuck, I sure hope he pays his bills. Is that where you are? Is John Dowd going to get paid? See, all this business about he won't take my advice and everything, I got this sneaking suspicion that, let's see, when did Dowd come on, Rick?
Was it summer of 2017, June, maybe?
Yeah, so we've got maybe six months of billable hours, and, you know, you kind of go, okay, 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of clients, especially if they're highfalutin, you know, well-moneyed, and they've got structures and shit like that, you know, they won't pay till, you know, 90 days anyway. They'll make you work for the bill. They'll make you work for what you've already earned.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, at 6 months, you figured out that's 290 days, and maybe you figured out that you've been stiffed. And maybe you go back and you read all the news articles about the plasterers and the carpenters and the drapers and the caterers who've all been fucked. And you look up and go, oh, he's doing it to me too, son of a bitch. I didn't think that was true. He seemed like such a nice guy. And then you go, see you, Don. You won't fucking pay me? Really? Good luck. I mean, does that strike you as being even remotely possible?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'd say at least half the time, you know, the reason attorneys fire clients, so to speak, is that, you know, they're not getting paid. You know, you have to get paid for what you do. And I mean,
well, and consider the guy who's still there is Jay Sekulow.
Yeah.
Now, yeah. Jay Sekulow has a tax-free hustle. That ACLJ,
right.
The American Center for Law and Justice, that was set up by one of the biggest grifters in this country, you know, former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson. So he's getting paid that way anyway. So he doesn't really have to worry about his billables with Trump.
I mean, he can essentially volunteer, and that'll be good for his reputation. I mean, you know, be that as it may, I guess it would be within his... within his clientele, you know, because they're, you know, basically his clients would be fellow maggots. Trump fans.
They're maggots.
Yeah, right.
But even then, doesn't that whole in-kind thing pop back up, or is it because it's, I mean.
As far as it being income to Trump, if basically they're donating the services to Trump and not making him pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a problem. It's called imputed income. Yeah.
Then Rick, at 4 minutes before the hour, how does he come out of this unscathed?
I don't know.
He's playing a game of Minesweeper, and the only and of the three dots in front of him, the one to either side and the three behind him, they're all mines.
They are.
Okay,
yeah,
so I'm not just losing it. I mean, we've walked through this process. You and I are pretty much in agreement.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other major legal development this week has been the emoluments clause, the lawsuit by the D.C. Mayor or whatever.
It's state's attorneys general. There's a couple
state's
of them.
State's attorney general, okay, for D.C. and Maryland. They actually have... standing to sue Trump for violating the emoluments clause because it affects businesses in their states by the you know, preferential treatment that Trump is giving, you know, by all the money that the diplomats, foreign diplomats, are paying to stay at the Trump Hotel. So, and that's an interesting one. That's led by the by a former ethics, I think even a White House ethics head, Norm Eisen, who's now with the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, it's known as. So,
right.
So that's interesting that lawsuit's being allowed to go forward. I mean, I don't know if an appellate court will find that they have standing to sue, but, you know, at least for now, you know, they do.
And one more question with all of this, And I really appreciate you letting me do the deep dive with this stuff because it's so it's so nerdy, and one of the things that you bring to the table is the ability to talk about it without sounding like Jeffrey Toobin or something like that on on the TV, or
yeah,
you know, one of those well-paid law nerds. We can talk.
I actually like Tubin, but yeah.
But you know what I mean.
He can kind of go over the head of the lay people sometimes.
You know, I think there are possibilities here, but you have to take into consideration the rule of perpetuities and the rule against perpetuities and mort main and you know, pretty soon you're lost among a bunch of shit that only first year law students really care about.
Well, you can't forget about legerdemain.
Well, of course not. No, legerdemain. No, no. And
which isn't even a legal doctrine.
No, no, ipso and ipso.
Sleight of hand, isn't that what that means?
Yeah, and ipso facto and
res ipsa loquitur. Loquitur.
Oh, goddamn! Absolutely, res ipsa loquitur. Son of a gun! Yeah. but here's one more, because I just got a note from James, and it says, unpaid lawyer bill, that's where you write your memoir book, paid in full.
There you go.
But is it there you go? To what extent could somebody like John Dowd write his tell-all and hang on to his license with because attorney-client privilege?
Yeah, that's very tricky. You would definitely need to have a...
So once upon a time, I had this client named David Dennison.
Yeah. let me tell you what I know about David Dennison in the words of Clive and Bundy or whatever,
yeah.
You know?
Let me tell you about the... Aaron, let me tell you about the Dennison.
Yeah, no, obviously you can't reveal any privileged communications. That's the difficulty of writing a memoir, at least an attorney
Okay, but let's take this a little further. What if those privileged communications are communications of an intent to perform an illegal act?
Well, you're talking about the crime or fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. That is something that... or not, the privilege is waived as to a certain communication.
Okay, you dropped out there for a minute, Rick. You said, you said you're talking about the crime of or fraud of on attorney-client privilege.
You're talking about the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege, and I think in general... you can't make that determination on your own as, let's say, John Dowd saying, oh, this was, you know, being pardoning Manafort and Flynn, you know, so that this whole thing would go away, you know. Yeah, that would probably be, you know, that's probably to further a crime or a fraud, because that is part of the obstruction. Mueller's investigation. And so, yeah, that would not be privileged, but I think it's a court that would have to make that determination that the crime fraud exception to the privilege applies. You see what I'm saying?
So you'd have to go and say, "Mother, may I?" to some, and what court of competent jurisdiction would you take that to?
Well, I don't think you could, Bob. I mean, you know, courts aren't in the business of rendering advisory opinions.
Yeah. So what? You roll the dice, you publish the thing, and then you get up the next morning and see if you've still got a law license?
I don't think you do that. I think you just don't write I just don't think you include details like that in your book. You could talk about your general impressions, what you think of Trump, what you think of Mueller, what you think of the charges, you know, that kind of thing, but I don't know that you can get into, you know, the advice given or communications that were made by Donald to you to secure legal advice, you know? So it would not be a very probative book, or it wouldn't be a very probing book, you know? It would be fairly...
And of course, there's a big difference between being White House...
I think...
There's a big difference between being White House counsel and... personal counsel to the guy who occupies the White House, correct?
Right, correct. You know, speaking of legal memoirs, I think it's a whole lot easier for a prosecutor to write legal memoirs than it is for a defense counsel to write a legal memoir. Just look at the, you know, the Manson case. What was the guy's name? Begins with a G. It begins with a B. Yeah, Vincent Bugliosi. He was able to write a memoir about the case because, the client, I mean, everything was in the part of the public record, you know? Yeah, I think once, you know, the thing is, it's maybe that's not the distinction. I think the distinction is whether if a case goes to trial, then you can probably get away with more in terms of disclosing stuff. Because I understand that I think Bob Shapiro wrote a book about the OJ case, and I think he cooperated in the making of that miniseries that occurred like about a year ago. Okay, it was a really good one. And I think some of the details in that miniseries were true, but I think there were some complaints that he had disclosed privileged communications. And I don't see anything happening to his law license there. So if a case is actually tried and it becomes a cause célèbre, I think you have maybe a little more, let's say, literary license as an attorney to reveal, secrets. But by and large, you really have to be careful what you say in a book. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, and I went down this road with one person in mind, and that's why I drew the distinction between White House counsel, who is an employee of the federal government, versus, the president's private lawyer,
Right.
because John Dean very famously spilled his guts.
Right. Well, and again, it was the crime fraud exception. So those communications with him to cover up the second rate burglary at a third rate hotel, they were not privileged.
And so White House counsel is Ty Cobb, right?
Yeah, it is Ty Cobb. Oh, no, he's the president's private counsel.
Okay, I thought.
Actually, Bob, I think John Dowd was the White House counsel. It's confusing. It's confusing. So for folks who don't know the difference, I mean, a lot of
No,
people don't.
the White House is the same guy.
Don McGahn, Don McGahn, Don McGahn.
Don McGahn, yes. Okay. Yeah, so I was incorrect. Ty Cobb is Trump's private defense counsel, as was John Dowd. Okay.
And Jay Sekulow.
Right, and Jay Sekulow. What a legal team. And Joe DiGenova is not going to step in. Boy, oh boy.
No, but
Not good this year.
as we discussed last night, and I mean, this is just a magnificent opportunity to dig into all of this. Have you read up on this Andrew Economou guy?
No.
Oh, well, you'll have to listen to last night's program, but a guy who made a fortune doing civil forfeiture on convenience stores that had illegal poker machines in Georgia and is at present a contract assistant prosecutor in Brunswick, Georgia on murder cases.
Oh, jeez.
And he's been referred to by Jay Sekulow as a brilliant strategist.
Oh, jeez.
But the larger issue that obtains here, Rick, is that again, I go back to that game of Minesweeper. I mean, this isn't even like Reagan with Iran-Contra. Hell, it's not even like Nixon and Watergate.
No, it's really not. This is much more multifaceted, more complicated, more people you've got,
And I mean,
or sub conspiracies within the larger conspiracy, you know?
this is an interesting concept. Earther with a note.
Still have a connection there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Earther with a note, subject line legal memoir. Maybe you do like Mike Papantonio did and write a completely fictional novel, in this case, starring protagonist Tonald Crime Horse Drump and his wife, Michelnia Loma Drump.
Oh, if that doesn't deserve a cowbell.
Oh, it absolutely does. As does the fact that this community tends to get on some sort of ESP wavelength and come up with things at the same time, because James, these two emails literally rolled in within seconds of each other. Subject line: John Grisham, fictionalize it. But then you get into the problem of what's real and what ain't.
Yeah. Well, plus fictionalizing it. I mean, if you make it a fictional president and you were actually counsel to the president, you know, that kind of causes problems. I mean, it's such a notorious case that you sort of, you know, the fictional angle is not necessarily going to work because people are going to know, you know, who your archetype characters really are, you know?
So,
stranger than fiction.
Well, yeah, it is. So do you have any passing familiarity with what happens? Let's say you're a guy and you're engaged in a racketeering influenced corrupt organization and your money's all just dirty as hell and you get busted for it. Isn't there a body of law that says it's okay for the feds to go after the lawyer's fees if they can be connected to the dirty business at hand?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if they can show that the fees came from the illegal business, yeah. In fact, that's one of the problems that white-collar attorneys have in representing Ponzi schemers and people like that, because they have to assure themselves that it's not dirty money. So they oftentimes have to have the client borrow from, let's say, family or friends who have actually legitimate income, okay, legitimate source of income, or let's say assets that they've had for a long time that aren't related to the crime that's being charged. I think that's called Glomar. I'm not sure. No, that's different. That's different. Now, Glomar is we can neither admit nor deny whether or not, you know, something is the case. That's a Glomar response. That's a government does that when they're, you know, when a request is made for information that may, let's say, involve, you know, secrecy concerns, national security, what have you, that kind of thing.
Is it possible? And I know he's hired a bunch of people and everything, and he's working with the sort of Damocles hanging over his head. But is it possible that there's so much of this stuff out there that Bob Mueller could simply get overwhelmed? That there's so much filth going in so many different directions that you just get buried in an avalanche of graft
sludge
and corruption and sleaze and filth.
Right? No, I don't think so. I'll tell you why. He's pretty laser focused on what the really big ideas in the case are. And that's sort of what he does. Okay, there might be a few different angles to go at, and he'll go with those angles. And he's not going to get, you know, he's not going to get confused by all the noise that you hear, you know, like.
Well, how do you staff something like that? Do you take lawyers A, B, C, and D and say, you're Russian banking and E, F, G, and H, you're the RNC meetings in Cleveland and I, J, K, and L, you're Stormy Daniels and any other sleazy, sexy time stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in situations where a bill comes out and you just, you know, you just take 20 pages of it and rip it off and hand it to somebody, and somebody else gets the next 20. And that's how you get, you know, a 500,000 page bill, whatever, probably not 20 pages, more like, you know, 200, but that's how you get one of those things digested in 24 hours. Is it that kind of compartmentalization?
I think so. I think so. Cause he's brought in a guy, who actually, let's see here. I'm trying to think who the cooperating witness is. He brought in a prosecutor from the Eastern District of New York, who's like really experienced at white collar frauds. And one of the cooperating witnesses was also that's the guy, that's Felix Sater. Okay. He's the guy who, you know, basically convinced Felix Sater to be a cooperator way back, like in 99 or whenever he had the problem with sticking the shattered champagne glass in somebody's face or eye or whatever, cut his face, I guess. And so he brought him in, and he's got a lot of experience in mob cases, especially involving New York real estate. Okay, so he's the guy, I think it's Andrew Weinstein or something like that, if memory serves. I think that is it. So he's brought, you know, Mueller's brought Andrew in to handle, you know, the whole thing with the Soho apartments and all the rich Russians that, you know, bought apartments for inflated prices to launder their money in the U.S. And, you know, and Donnie, of course, had an ownership interest in that or developed it or something. You know, so he's going to be doing that aspect of things. So that's sort of kind of like a money laundering angle. You're going to have other guys who are going to be involved in maybe the illegal campaign contribution aspect of things. You'll have other guys who are skilled in, let's say, public corruption and obstruction cases, you know. So there's all kinds of, you know, expertise that these attorneys that are brought into the team, you know, bring to bear on the case. And, you know, it's supposedly one of the, you know, it's a stellar team. I mean, these are all former, most of them are former DOJ attorneys who then went into private practice and are, you know, partners in major firms, that type of thing. So these are very, you know, high quality attorneys, really tough prosecutors. And, you know, they know how
these aren't guys who got snatched out of Brunswick, Georgia and contract assistant DA jobs.
No, definitely not. They're not graduates of Liberty University either. Like Agent whatever Starling was in the Bush administration, you know, who was supposedly involved in, who was tasked with, you know, being the head of something that she had no business heading.
Right.
So, well, anyway, maybe we should yield the floor here, Bob. Let some other folks talk here.
Oh no, that's where I was gonna go next. Hey, Steve from Georgia, Stan, you've been as quiet as a mouse.
Raw dog, what's going on, Gordo?
You've been waiting all night for that, haven't you?
Do I get a bell for that or not? No, probably
no,
not.
I'm not rewarding Raw Dog. Now, that phrase was all over the goddamn internet. How come I get pasted with it?
And I double banged you with Gordo too.
Yeah, I know. So. I got the Gordo too. I'm gonna go rub my ass on the couch after the program's over.
Too funny. Oh man, that's been ongoing for what, a week now or?
Gordo? He's been no. We've been talking about Gordo
not
for
Gordo,
a good
Raw
solid.
Dog.
Yeah. That's yeah. That and I know who I have to thank for that too.
That's Jim, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Jim.
Oh, it's too funny. This is the last porch for a while.
Nobody
it,
calls up Hartman and says, "Hey, Raw Dog."
Yeah.
No respect.
Highbrow for that.
No respect.
Too highbrow. This is the last Friday on the front porch for a few weeks, isn't it, Bob? Or am I not?
Well,
hearing?
No. There will be a Friday, unless I'm just completely just wiped by the end of next week. No, we'll have we should have Friday on the front porch next week and the week after.
Oh, okay. I was under the impression you were filling in for Mike. I am
filling in for Mike, but not on Friday.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I'm Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Well, that's awesome. I'm sure you'll knock them down over there, man.
And then the week after, I'm gone to D.C. But again,
yep.
Barring things like blowouts on the rental car and parking on, yeah. You know, parking on I-66 and shit.
Going
I should,
jail.
I've never been to. Why do you? Why you've got this paranoid thing that happens that every time I go to D.C., I'm going to wind
PR,
up in the
man.
Gray Bar Hotel.
They don't call you Raw Dog for nothing, man.
Oh, god damn it!
He's always been the wheel man for the people that go to jail.
That's right. That's right. He comes and gets them out.
That's not the nature of this trip anyway. Nobody's protesting nothing. But no, I should be back for Friday on the front porch there too. But before we go any further though, I got a great note from Matt in San Francisco. Subject: well, just can you imagine about the Mueller business? Can you imagine being in a recap meeting with Mueller and his team I'd probably go back to drinking. Oh, I'd come in with like one of those Camelback hydration bags filled with tequila, and the little tube just run right into my mouth. It, swirly straw be damned. Now, stone cold sober, and this stuff gets is confusing and frankly maddening. You know, how do we manage to have a system that just allows this shit to go on and on and on and on? That's kind of the back to drinking part for me.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a diversion to so many other real world problems: mountaintop removal, climate change, the over prison population. I was watching a movie called Survivor's Guide to Prison, and I say it jokingly, but you'd be surprised how easily an innocent person can wind up in the hooch gal. In fact, Rick, you may be able to back me up on this. Doesn't the average schmo commit 3 felonies a day, unbeknownst to him?
That seems a little tall.
That's what they were saying, though, Bob, and I was thinking, how? But, yeah, watch it. It streams on, I think, Amazon's rolling it. I'm not sure. I can't remember where I watched it, but it's very disturbing. And I tried to really watch what I was doing one day, and we were in the checkout line, and Karen said, here, sign this credit card receipt for me. And I'm like, nope, I'm not an authorized signer. Now, I don't know if that would be considered a felony or not.
Yeah, that's one of those places where that might sound a little too much like legal advice. So
right, yeah. But I didn't do it. But check it out if you get a chance, Bob. And I encourage the Horn family too. If you want a diversion, if you want to jump into one hell pit to another, it's just the legal system and the way the prison for profit. It's the way it's geared. It's effed up. It really is, and there are a lot of good people. They're sitting in prison that didn't do a damn thing, man.
Well, somewhere along the way, they got themselves popped by police. But talk about, they're sitting in prison, and then there's laying in a box. And one of the stories that I wanted to make sure this evening did not get completely run over by the L'Affaire du Trump is the information we got about the killing of Stephon Clark that came out today, which sounds a hell of a lot like murder now, cold-blooded murder. The family of Stephon Clark paid for a second autopsy as opposed to just taking the word of the county coroner. And that's wise on their part. Turns out, Stephon Clark, and here on this program, I think I was talking about this before a lot of others were.
You were.
Stephon Clark, I mean, this is just sickening to describe. He was gunned down after 2 Sacramento police officers discharged their weapons 20 times and hit him 8 times. They shot him in the back. He wasn't even facing them.
And this happened in front of his grandmother as well. Is that correct?
At her home.
Oh, man. I mean, that's a family that's ruined.
And it's another one of those cases where there's you know, video evidence, and do you believe your lying eyes? Kind of like when the cop in Tulsa gunned down the African American man and said, "He scared me. He was a coming at me when he's standing still." And you can see her just blow him away, and she walked. But the details that came out from this autopsy are absolutely horrifying. He made no move toward the officers and was apparently trying to get on the ground, if you watch the video, and that's when they shot him in the back. He was hit in the back, in the thigh, and in the neck. And then, then, I mean, they're still shooting at him when he's on the ground, because you can see sparks fly from the from them shooting at the ground. Dear God. And then it just gets skeevier, because among other things, on the body cam, you know, remember how body cams were going to be the solution to all the problems? Well, they let him lay there. The pathologist who did the autopsy said it likely took him 6 to 10 minutes to die. And so the cops just stood there and watched him die. And then eventually, minutes and minutes and minutes afterward, one of the two cops says, "Should we, do CPR?" And the other cop says, "Hey, mute!" Meaning, mute your body cam mic. And then, whoop, no more audio. What's the point? What is the damn point of a body cam that the cop has the power to turn off or mute?
Might as well not even have one.
I mean, do the body cams keep rolling when there's not a problem? And it justifies the action of the cops. And of course, all the little Blue Lives Matter fucks out there are running around. "Well, he was jumping over a fence. He was running away.
He smashed a window." When did that become a capital offense?
Right. And you know, it's really cute when Ferris Bueller did it, running through people's backyards like a little vandal and leaping over fences and grabbing sandwiches off of plates and stopping to leer at a girl in a bikini and shit. But that's just the movies. In reality, if you're a black guy, you get blown away.
By the people the taxpayers are paying to protect and serve you. Jesus.
And meanwhile, I don't know if you saw this, but the White House issued a statement saying, "Well, this is a local matter." You know, if the last 5 years or more have taught us anything, it is that police violence against people of color is anything but a local matter. It's a goddamn national epidemic.
Epidemic, absolutely. Took the words right out of my mouth.
State Attorney General is looking into it.
Yeah, that's who, Becerra?
Javier Becerra, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know what to say about beyond pointing out the outrageous nature of what happened. So, am I safe in presuming that police training now, I mean, and not just California, pretty much anywhere, is shoot first and ask questions later?
Yeah, I think you're right, Bob. And I think if you're going to shoot, you want to make sure you shoot to kill, you know, go for the body mass, you know?
Right. And,
you know, cause, you know.
And as Robert from Australia points out, at no time did they say, "Stop, it's the police. Halt." At no point do the officers identify themselves. It's dark. That's infrared camera footage everybody's seeing. And they just came in and started blazing.
Jesus.
And the one thing that I think it's easy to overlook in all of this, and this is by no means an excuse, but cops are trigger happy because we have a culture where anybody and everybody could be gunned up. So you got to, even though they're armored up and it's, you know, far less likely that they're going to be killed than their victim will be. they've got itchy trigger fingers because they're scared to death of people with guns. And
why, sure.
I can't help but think that some percentage, some statistical element of this is related to that. That they do shoot first and ask questions later because you never know when somebody's going to shoot back. Or not shoot back, but shoot first. And they're damn
exactly.
sure they're damn sure not going to get ambushed. And it took 3 to 10 minutes for this young man to lay there bleeding out and dying in the most horrifying imaginable agony. I mean, you got two firearms. Let's just do basic division, cranking out. You know, how long does it take? I mean, you can watch the video. How long does it take to discharge 10 rounds? And of course, you couple this with the fact that they are taught, you know, just like that Secretary of State candidate in the Commonwealth of Kentucky stand said, "I was trained center mass."
Right.
When he was threatening to assassinate a sitting member of the United States House of Representatives. So, you know, as I watched various and sundry forms of for-profit media today, I kept noticing that there was a hell of a lot more talk about that goddamned episode of the Return of Roseanne than there was a 22-year-old man who whose children never get to interact with him again,
and whose family's destroyed.
I mean, I've recently been accused of being too sympathetic to the black people because I don't talk about all the gang. Yeah, because I don't talk about all the gang banging. And
that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Well, you know, the individual who said this, and I talked about it the other night, his life has been impacted by gun violence. And he says that the gun violence was perpetrated by people of color. So apparently, according to him, I am. When I didn't read his first email, he wrote back accusing me of somehow shading the discussion. But apparently, for every time that a person of color gets massacred in this country, I'm supposed to find a balancing story where some gangbanger made mayhem somewhere else in the country. But in point of fact, most of the stories that I bring out, ethnicity is not even is not even discussed in the article, and you only find out something if you see a photograph. But I've been accused of that, and it's insulting, and it's also
pull your hair out.
Well, no, I mean he accused me. You're no better than Fox News.
That would make me
want
to pull my hair out.
You've gone so far over to the other side. But the fact of the matter is, what we're talking about here is just reality.
And being objective. You don't have to go tit for tat for everything when you see something as outrageous as this.
Well, I mean, and this does appear on its face to be outrageous.
6 to 10 minutes when they're sitting there just looking at each other while this guy's just suffering, his life's ebbing away, and his grandmother's nearby. I can't think of anything more horrific.
Yeah, hey, where you want to go to dinner when this is all over? Well, I don't know. I was thinking we might go to the Subway. I'm tired of Subway. Hey, you reckon he's bled out yet? No, it looks like he's still breathing. Pizza then. You want to go for pizza?
Jesus.
Of course, we'll never know what they were talking about because
they was on mute.
They muted their mic. And of course, by the way, any body cam footage, the video is useless because, again, it was dark.
The police are always given the benefit of the doubt most of the time.
Yeah. Hi, Larry.
Except if you're an African-American police officer who kills a white woman, and then you go to trial. But, you know, we just love our police officers and we love our soldiers. And, you know, they're protecting us from all kinds of horrible crap.
Yeah, but Larry, honestly, do you think there would be a decrease in this if the cops didn't have to be scared to goddamn death that everybody was you know potentially carrying at least as good a weaponry as they are?
I think you make a very good argument that we should not be encouraging people to get guns, and we shouldn't make it easy for people to get guns. If you live in, you know, there, I've talked with Devin about this before and a few other people, and he made a point. He said to me, people in rural America use their guns for hunting, or if they're in a situation where the law enforcement authorities can't get to them very quickly, and they need to have guns in those situations. And, you know, in that sense, he explains why rural folks don't get urban folks. But he said that usually what happens is if somebody shoots somebody with a gun in rural America, they don't blame the gun, they blame the person.
I blame the person with the gun. When somebody gets shot, and yeah, I understand what Devin's getting at there, but more and more it doesn't hold so much water anymore. If you've got a farm, sure, maybe you've got a 223 for varmints, you know, maybe you've got a varmint gun because varmints are very real, and so okay, we'll cut them some slack there.
Well.
You got a 12 gauge for turkey hunting. Maybe you got a 10 gauge for goose hunting. You got a 30-06 for deer season, and maybe you're a real dead eye, and you got a plain old 22 for squirrel season. Because who likes to spit out lead shot? Okay, that's all well and good. That's rural culture. It's not a way of living because there's not enough wildlife in this country to actually support people if they had to live on it, because we are way too overpopulated for something like that. Mm-hmm. But as I pointed out on, I think, Monday, the response time of the police in the case I was talking about. Okay, so I had the story, last night out of Temple, Texas, about the 7-year-old who shot the 11-month-old, and it was inside a house that had a sign on the front door that said, "The average response time for the police is 23 minutes. The average response time of a 357 Magnum is 1,400 foot per second." I've seen that shit on doors around here, too. We don't, you know, an outline of a smoking revolver and the words, "We don't call 911. Okay? And in one of those houses in Temple, Texas, a 7-year-old shot his, 7-month-old sibling because the Freedom Protector was left out. But what I was getting at is, let's say I go over to my local Wally World. At my local Wally World, the response time of the Fayetteville police is about a minute and a half because they're usually cruising the parking lot. And they don't have to go and find a parking space if they're called. They just pull up to the door, jump out, and go in. So, why is it that Cletus Fanhammer has to carry, has to carry a semi-automatic pistol with a 19-round capacity in it into Walmart to get a loaf of bread and a jug of milk. Somebody explain that to me, please. And the only answer I got is that he's a chicken shit. Being rural does not automatically make you somehow more brave than some sissified, cowardly city dweller, which is generally how they're often thought of in this case.
Some psychologists have said that the reason why the NRA is getting away with selling all these guns is that the a male in this culture has lost a job, and their wives don't need living, and males have, their self-esteem is lacking. They don't have a job. They have no future. They don't feel like they're the provider anymore in the family structure. So therefore, the NRA will sell them the idea of having a gun, and therefore you have your manhood. You have your gun, you have your manhood.
You don't feel emasculated anymore.
Well, that's why from time to time I refer to them as blue steel penis extensions. Cletus Fanhammer feels a little bit more like a man when he's got a gun strapped to his hip. Or, maybe Tommy Lauren feels like a little more like a wall man when she's got an AR-15 stuffed down the front of her yoga trousers.
Well, I take your point that if we didn't have such a virulent gun culture, and I'm sure that there are quite a few people, although I can't verify it, but I make the assumption that there are some people in Berkeley that have guns, and they might even be liberal folks too, very liberal folks. But I'm just assuming that, and I don't know that for certain. But if you had a lot fewer guns, and you didn't have a law that said that people have a right to have a gun, and if people weren't ginned up with all this fear and all this anxiety, you'd probably have a cop culture that was a hell of a lot more peaceful than you do. And you'd have a lot less of this stuff that's going on right now. Although I have friends, the same friends that I talk with you in San Diego, who are telling me, well, Larry, you're talking about Black Lives Matter, but what about the police officer that's scared to death every time they go out on a call that they're going to get shot up or something?
Then he or she is in the wrong damn line of work.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you don't go into copping for the fabulous salary and benefits.
Yeah, that's true.
Because we don't pay our cops that particularly well.
No, we don't.
And in many instances, we get what we pay for.
Yeah.
Some starting salaries are as low as $16,500. I mean, just ridiculous.
Well, in a little tiny bit of nothing incorporated town in a place like West Virginia, do you realize that quite often the single biggest line item in a little town's budget can be the care and feeding of a couple of cops? And even so, they're not getting paid worth a damn. And I bet the same thing applies in Alabama or Georgia, Stan, Steve.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
there's no there's no requirement of a college education.
Well, Bob, I can tell you in Berkeley, at least last time I asked, which was a number of years ago, if you are a police officer in Berkeley, you have to have a bachelor's degree. You have to have a BA in order to be a cop.
Well, that ain't the truth in your stand states, Larry. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just telling you that's not the case. And what'll happen if you if you're, for instance, a member of the cream of the crop in a state like West Virginia, they want a college education for the state police. And then they will even go so far as to fund you getting a master's degree. Because they want to they want to create the impression that in fact the police are educated, the state police. But you want to be somebody's town cop? You want to be a sheriff's deputy? No. Yeah. And in a lot of cases, the degrees that they do have are those bullshit criminal justice degrees. And I'm probably offending somebody, but you know what I'm talking about. It's basically trade school for cops.
Well, universities have criminal justice administration degrees. I don't know what West Virginia has, although I know that they have a very good engineering department. That I know about. But, you know, I don't know whether West Virginia teaches criminal justice. But there are quite a few universities that have degrees
in criminal justice administration. Yeah, sure. And that's things like how does the probation system work? And, you know, how do we manage our prison industrial complex?
Yeah.
If you're a guy who's running whose job is to run up and down the interstate, handing out speeding tickets and busting drunk drivers, there's not much a criminal justice degree is going to do for you.
I have a diversionary pop culture question to ask you.
Okay.
About West Virginia. I'm looking to see if I'm living in West Virginia, especially if I'm living where Devin is living or someplace or where you're living, and I want to, and I have cable television. I don't know who your cable provider is or who Devin has, if he's got one, but if you're living in an area where you can't get a radio signal or a TV signal because you've got the government there and you want to watch the Pittsburgh Pirates or you want to watch the Penguins or you want to watch the Steelers or whatever, how are you able to access cable in order to be able to see that?
That's a question for Devin. Devin deals with that kind of thing. I got nothing. I mean, I've got a crappy ass cable company, because
you don't need cable to watch them, Larry. You can watch anything you want to watch online.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if you're living where Bob is living.
Well, I'm not in the quiet zone. Devin is.
Got an internet connection that's good. You can watch anything you want.
Okay, well,
any
all right.
Sports game, anything that goes on around the world.
Okay, I'll take that as an answer.
I don't know that that's entirely accurate as it addresses the quiet zone. The quiet zone, you know, there's no radio signals. Because the whole point of the quiet zone is to make sure that there's no radio interference between that government installation, surveillance, radio, whatever. And their ability to get the signals from things like nuclear submarines.
All right, but in your home where you are, if you had it, you'd have access to it.
Oh, I've actually got a crummy little antenna hooked up to a television, and I can get our ABC affiliate in HD.
Okay,
but again, I'm not. I'm not in the quiet zone.
Okay.
Let me share a couple of notes that have come in. Note coming in from Darlene in Connecticut. What do you expect with the trigger happy cops? After all, a certain candidate for president said he could train a gun on center mass, paraphrasing, in the middle of Times Square, and his base would still love him, and he got elected in the end. So, and not only did that, he say that, he didn't say they'd still just love him. He said he'd never lose a vote. Now, there, okay, now there's one of those law school hypotheticals that I was talking with Billable Rick about. Mm-hmm. If you want to charge somebody with a felony, generally speaking, you've got to go and get a warrant. Unless the law officer in question witnesses the commission of the felony. I mean, that's just a broad rule. So, if, for instance, I mean, the reason that these two cops let go with 20 rounds and hit Stephon Clark with 8 of them is because they claimed to have perceived a threat to themselves. I think they were just wetting their pants and decided to kill the guy because they were terrified from jump. But in that situation Darlene just brought up, and Agent Fred, this isn't any of that. There's nothing. This is a hypothetical question. What if someone in a position of extreme high authority and power was standing in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shooting people? Would the police return fire?
It would depend upon whether or not there was enough backup and enough police officers there in order to be able to take care of the situation.
I think you've jumped the gun, Larry. You know, you're on Fifth Avenue in New York City. You're a beat cop. And the most powerful man on earth, having previously threatened to do so at one point, begins randomly shooting people. Do you, as a beat cop, return fire, or do you stand to attention and salute? Now that's an out there hypothetical. But we've never had a president before who has said that he has the power and the authority and the animal magnetism to be able to shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote over it. Because that statement, when he made it, was terrifying on a number of levels. And one of those levels is the idea that he would get away with it, that no one would oppose him, that he would be a law unto himself, which of course is the direct antithesis of everything, and I do mean everything, that this country purportedly stands for. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Rick?
Well, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think in your hypothetical, I think the officer, if he had a clear shot and wouldn't hit pedestrians that were innocent bystanders, I think he'd have to shoot back, no matter who the, assailant was, you know?
Well, the point here is that we have too many guns, and it's too easy for people to get a gun and to have a gun. People feel it's the right to have a gun, and they don't even, you know, and also people are too concerned, are too worried about whether or not there's going to be somebody around the next corner, at any one point in time, that's going to be a threat to themselves or a threat to their families, and they feel that they need to have a gun. And it's that kind of mentality that drives a lot of this. And I understand it because we live in an alienated a culture where people don't feel ties, they don't feel close to each other, and they don't feel really well connected to each other or to a community. And I'm going off and on. Before I go too far, you know, out, I'll just say we have too many guns. You know, it's too easy for people to rationalize having a gun, and there are too many guns out there. Now, you know, if somebody comes in to my apartment and tries to, you know, I have no way to defend myself, but I don't have any reason, at least at this point in time, to feel that I need to have a gun to protect myself.
Precisely.
And
precisely, Larry, if you're one of those gun humpers who says, you know, I got me an AR-15 and a sawed-off 12-gauge, and I can run 100 rounds through that AR-15 with my bump stock in about 3-4 seconds. And you're worried about someone home invading your ass? You need to rethink rethink the way you're living your life and the number of enemies you're making.
Yeah.
You're not living in any town USA. You're apparently living in Moga freaking Dishu.
Well, you know, people watch the news and they see that if it bleeds, it leads, and they see these stories, and people feel, you know, and if all I had coming into my head and into my eyes were news stories of somebody shooting somebody up or some nasty stuff happening, which the news likes to cover, my whole world would probably be focused. If I didn't have, you know, a broad perspective, my whole world would probably be focused on, hell, the world's dangerous. Well, the world's dangerous. Well, I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Oh, I do.
I give people more credit than that, but.
You may very well give them more credit than they're due. Meanwhile, I have to dole out a cowbell.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that wasn't a criticism. But, I have to dole out a cowbell here toward the end of the program. And that goes out to Brother Deacon Asa, who, hearing my hypothetical, responded, Bob, I doubt if Vladimir Putin would ever stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot people. Brilliant. Well stated. Well stated, yeah. Indeed. And I need to send out thanks to Joan. Thank you very kindly to Joan. We were not fundraising this evening, but Joan jumped in just the same. Thank you very, very kindly, Joan. That's a huge help going into the weekend and the end of the month. And I cannot thank you enough. And thanks again for the challenge coming up. I think Joan was responding to Tom's challenge. So that is so. Tom, thank you for making the challenge, and Joan, thank you for responding to it. Thank you very, very much indeed. And so, at the end of what has been, I hope, an interesting and engaging Friday on the front porch, it's time to wrap up. And so I'll say thanks to everybody who joined into the conversation this evening. Thank you to Sparky for moderating, as ever. And thank you to Steve from Georgia Stan, and thank you for all the acumen, Billable Rick, and thank you for your observations, Larry, there in Berkeley. Thank you very kindly. Whoever was trying to dial in to here to get into the group, I can't add you from here. You got to go through Sparky. I'm sorry about that, but that's how it works. And we have to use Skype. Thanks, everybody. This is the last broadcast of the month of March 2018. Thank you for getting us to the end of the month and helping us meet our fundraising goal for this month. We begin a new one come Sunday. And thank you very kindly, among many, many others, thank you very kindly to Ralphs for the Trash Fitz Walker Stand Challenge. That added a little bit to the end of the month. Thank you very kindly indeed. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaged in this little conversation in whatever way you choose so to do, whether you do it live or whether you do it via podcast, whether you listen via the download from iTunes or whether you download from Podbean, podbean.com. I post that every evening on my Facebook page, makes it easy to get at it. I also post a link on Twitter. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you this week to both of our chat room moderators. Thank you to Steve, and thank you to Sparky. Thank you very kindly to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia, working to rebuild headonradionetwork.com. Thank you to Brother Deacon Asa, without whom we'd be dead in the water, for his provision of headon.live, HEADON.LIVE. Thank you very kindly, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. The number of hours of programming that have been served out by WhiteRoseSociety.org, number in the billions. And Ben Birch has never sent a bill. Thank you, Ben. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And I hope everybody has a happy Easter or a pagan Eostre or just, you know, a nice weekend. Back Monday, all programs next week will be, except Friday, all program Monday through Thursday will be two-hour programs, and then I'll be filling in for Malloy from 9 to 11. So I hope you'll be around for both programs. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a great weekend, everybody. Later.